So I remember my first year in yeshiva, and I was in Kamenetz. I grew up in Borough Park. I went to Kamenetz, and not only when I was in Kamenetz, had I never heard of Chofetz Chaim when I was in 12th grade. I never even heard of Queens. And I remember when two members of the Kollel came down to recruit for Chofetz Chaim in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Fromwoods, Rabbi Tzadok Fromwoods, and Rabbi Ben Tzion Chait came down to recruit. Rabbi Fromwoods had gone to Kamenetz for high school, so I connected with him. It was they only were allowed to recruit there for 2 years. I think within the 2 years, they got like 12 guys to come. Many of them went through the system, myself, my brother, Misharfman, and there were others, not for now. And so I went, there was a fluke that we went to Eretz Yisrael. We were supposed to go to Merkz Atara, all of us. And the last second, we switched to Chofetz Chaim. And then the Reshiva came, Hanukkah time, to Eretz Yisrael. I have like 25 first cousins on both sides of the family. Every one of them were doctors, lawyers, accountants, serious, you know, businessmen, and it had not ever dawned on me. I didn't even know how to spell chinuch. I didn't know what chinuch was. And not only wasn't I thinking of going to chinuch, I didn't even know what that was. Like the rebbeim I had in Kamenetz were, you know, heavy Lakewood accent. I respected them very much, but they didn't have the old American look. They're not dawn upon me at all. And so I was in this in Eretz Yisrael. Things were going very well. Then the Reshiva came Hanukkah time. He ate in the Yeshiva Friday night. And the Reshiva, like I say, he was very blunt. Okay. He was very blunt. He said the same thing over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And he started Friday night that when we finished this, as we finished eating, he was there with First Rebbetzin. And he says, okay, let's get down to business. Rebbeim make about $60,000, about 70 out of town. Assistant principals started going through salaries. And we need plenty of manpower, and you need to go, and we need plenty of people. I turned to the NHA, what is this guy talking about? I don't know what he was talking about. What was he talking about? I thought it was French. I know what he was talking about. And that's why he said that there are so many Jewish neshamas out there who are desolate. There's no one to connect with them. And says, I'm already an old man, and who's going to do it? There's no one to do it. They're just like lost. And whatever amount of people we lost in the Holocaust, it's going to be double that, triple that, quadruple that, just from intermarriage. So you have to help them out. Your brothers have to help them out. They're desperate. They're calling. And they need us. So you have to help us out. I still don't know what he's talking about. I didn't know who was talking to him. There were some guys here, I still don't know me, the older guys. I didn't know at all who he was talking to. But by the time his visit was over, he was there for like a week. You know, he made an appointment. Anyone that wanted to make an appointment with him could speak to him. And so I made an appointment. The guys were coming out of that meeting there saying that the Reshiva told them they should go and they should learn that you should become Rosh Hashivas. So I went to one of my friends. I said, what did he tell you? He says, I think I should become Rosh Hashiva. I said, ay, yay. So you have an appointment? I said, yeah, I'm going to go now. I said, why? Because something must be screwy here. You know, like I was pitching myself. I said, you know, that guy was very smart, so I said, I'm going to go in there, but now I'm going to be embarrassed because, you know, I have to tell them that he told me to become Rosh Hashiva, But I know he's not gonna tell me that. He'll probably tell me like they need a custodian in the, you know, some school somewhere. I couldn't be masochist, not one bit. Couldn't be masochist at all. So I went into the meeting. I was petrified. My friends made me go. I didn't want to go. I was petrified what he was going to tell me. Like I felt like, you know, like what's his name just told me. What's his name? Graduated this past year. Yair. What's this Friday boy's name?
Yonatan.
Yeah, Yonatan. What's his last name?
Michael.
Yeah, Yonatan. So he told me he went to Reb Chaim Kanievsky, just texted me right at the end of, and Reb Chaim Kanievsky stared into my eyes for like 20 seconds. So Rebbe, I was never so petrified in my life. He has no idea what he was looking at. But he just stared into him for 20 seconds. He says his life has changed from that stare. 20 seconds. So I was going into this office over there to speak to Rashiva, and I knew I had to ask her what he thinks I should do. So I walked out of there. I couldn't believe it. He says, if you're learning yeshiva, you'll become a Rashiva. I still didn't know what that means. So when I want to relate to now, I'm not the Rashiva, but I think in reflecting back with the benefit of time, because that was December of 79, so 99, that's like 4 years ago. So with the benefit of time, I see that it wasn't such a big chiddush. It was a very big chiddush to me, but if a person learns, a person applies himself, a person will become great in yeshiva. And yes, you become a yeshiva, everyone. There is no shortage, everyone. If everyone works on themselves, you learn how to learn, you learn what a piece of musar is, you learn what a halacha is, you know, you'll know how to paskin if you learn it. I always like telling all the story. I was learning with Rabbi Meza, the one in LA. We were learning Hilchos Hatova Meitiv, the wines. And I remember when we finished learning the Siman, I said, I have no idea what we just learned. There were so many different shittas, and I can't find it. If you asked me any halachas, I wouldn't help. And I remember, I don't know if I said it or I thought it, we went on, and then I was still single then. Then fast forward many, many years later, I ended up here in Miami. One of the base manager guys, Johnny Weiss, was here, was eating over at my house. He's like a classy guy, brought over a fancy bottle of wine to my house. I'm not recommending you do that because it's gonna go to waste because I hate all wines. But I know when it's a classy bottle, but I'm not gonna enjoy it. So, you know, unless you wanna drink it, you're welcome to drink it. But, so he opened this classy bottle of wine. I said, wow, I mean, it's very nice. I said, we'll drink it tonight. And I make Kiddush and I realize I forgot the bottle in the kitchen. So after we washed, I had to bring the bottle out to the table, and then we both looked at each other like, what about the Bracha Tova Meitiv? We get a better bottle of wine to the table. In addition to the Bari Pir Gafen, you may not have to make, but a new bottle that's brought out that's better than the previous one, you may have to make a Bracha Bracha Tova Meitiv. So I said, oh, I learned those halachas. So we took that Mishnah Berurah. I said, okay, I didn't figure it out in 2 weeks in yeshiva. How am I gonna figure it out now at the table? You know, I took it out, and then within 5 minutes, I knew all the halachas, because I learned it already. I knew the shittas, but I don't know why. The first time it didn't make sense. When I did it at the table, everything made sense. We passed on halachas, and we're so scared. We all of us, every single one of us, I remember, everyone has a lower image of themselves, which is very often the Yetzer Hara. You know, it's not good to have a higher image of yourself either. You know, you should be realistic. But every single person can become great if they learn yeshiva, if they learn. A person learns and tries to accomplish, they become great. Rabbi Sharfman, I saw it. He was my roommate for many years. He every night kept a Kitzah Shulchan Aruch and Piskei Mishnah Berurah next to his bed. and he did a little bit every night, and he became great in halacha. It isn't because he was born that way. He wasn't born, he was very bright, but he internalized it. His father was a rav. I mean, all those things didn't hurt. But he just every night, every day, you do a little bit. And you don't have to use all of your kochos and maximizing it to your full potential to become great. Regretfully, a person can become, I mean, the more you do, the more you accomplish, but a person can become pretty great by just doing regular speed, you know, regular speed. I would caution people not to overdo it because they want to become great, because usually run out of steam. So, you know, every person knows their pace. You know, you check with your BAM, are you doing too much? If you're feeling stressed, it's probably too much. And you take it a little slower. But a person could become great just by staying with it. So anyway, so I wanted to, again, this is not a brainwashing session, so I'm not trying to tell anyone to go into chinuch, but I want to give you the reasons a person wanted to go into chinuch, why one would, if they would, why would they want to go into chinuch. So I wrote that I prepared tonight. I came up with four reasons. The pros, okay? So here's the problem. I want to just do the ruchniyistic reasons first. Okay, but you know, everyone's gonna be waiting for the practical reasons. That's number four. You have to suffer through three of them first. Okay, the first one is just remarkable that the schus. Listen to this. The Gemara says in Yuma, I'm quoting now, "Bishvil yachid she'asa tshuva, molchlin l'chol ha'olam." If one person does tshuva, it's a good mussar for ourselves also. If one person, could be one of us, and one person does tshuva, the entire world gets a mechila. And Rav Moshe Feinstein explains that if one person does tshuva, mistama, other people are going to learn from him. Unless he's living on an island by himself. But one person changes, you don't even know, you can't know. People will see that, it's going to affect them, and that's melem mochel chol ha'olam. Just from the sheer hashpah that he had in his Abbatzes Torah, that zchus will make him, HaKadosh Baruch Hu views that mochel chol ha'olam because of it, because it's the vada hashpah. He brings a raya. Moshe brings a raya, which is fascinating. The raya is in Parshas Vayelech. So the pasuk says that a person is going to eat. The Baruch Shalom says a person is going to eat, be satisfied, and get fat. And then it says he'll go and they will serve other gods, and they will get me angry. So Rav Moshe asks, why is it start b'lashon yachid and end b'rabim? Says that he's going to eat and get satisfied and get fat, and then they will serve other gods. And he writes that if a person does things which are makulkal, other people are going to learn from it. I would never repeat over this Rav Moshe, but then he writes that kol shkein, if a person does a maisim tovim, person does the right thing, of course, people are going to learn from him. And that's pshat when we say in Ava Rabba, lilmod olamed, lishma lasos. How do you write lilmod olamed? Most people are not lilmodes. They're not giving shiurim, they're not giving any classes, they're not doing even daf yomi classes. And they're nothing. Where's the lalamid? So Moshe says the lalamid is for even anoshim pshutim, who can't necessarily teach, but simply for maisim tovim. So kolshkein, a person is doing it, you know, with hinni muchen mezumen. I'm going to try and help others do it. That's certainly mochlin l'chol ha'olam. It's a tremendous chus. Then I was telling anyone that would listen this week in Noach, Parshas Noach. So it says that Noach spent 120 years trying to. Why did it take 120 years? Even the little kids from Torah Semes came home with the sheets. And they said 120 years, so people should ask, why are you milling a teva? And I'll tell them the reason, you have to do tshuva. And this will get people to do tshuva. Okay, and I heard Rabbi Gita shmooz on that also. Okay, beautiful. And there's a Rashi which says that Noach's children, his sons, Shem, Ham, and Yapa, is mining the teva, bischus Noach. Because what kind of schus will be for Noach to be saved if his children are going to die? So Noach's children, Shem, who became the big Rosh Shiva, Shem, Ham, and Yafes, at that point had not done tshuva, and they were only zochet to go into the teva because of Noach. Later on, they did do tshuva, and Shem did tshuva. So I assume the others also to an extent. But and they only went in because of Noach. So it comes out that the only people that Noach was not Makarev like anybody. There was no one that he was Makarev, because I assume they would have been saved had they done tshuva. So Noach saved nobody. He wasn't Makarev anyone. Yet it says, the Sforno says, that it says, Vayishalech Noach es Elokim, and then right away it says, Vayilad Noach Sholosh Banim. So the Sforno makes a juxtaposition because the two psukim that he was Mesalech Noach es Elokim, means he was being Marbet's Torah, he was trying to teach his dar, and because of that he had the children. Because he was, the quote is, Me'oz Shehizkiel Lochiach Nedaro Zach Lebanim. Because he was being Marbet's Torah, to give Musar to all of his community, he was Zoche to have children. Because of the Schus of Marbet's Torah, he wasn't Makar of anybody. So that's the second reason. That we see that the tremendous Schus involved, the person's Marbet's Torah, it's a very, very tremendous schus. Noach, I guess, was the Torah says some great praises about him, but yet he was zochet to children because of his Avatzes Torah. So we see there's a tremendous amount of schus in Avatzes Torah. It's a very, very laudable and very, very special thing. That would be a second reason that I was thinking. And the third thing, then we get to the nitty gritty, the third is that there's such a thing called an expense account. If I work for an accounting firm, so they have these vast accounting methodologies that when you go on business, you go on the business expense account. You fly, one person told me he flies first class all over the place on the company's business account. They can't expect him to fly. So I'm not talking about a local, commercial flight. But if he's traveling to, far away, they can't expect him to sit there and coach some window mill seat and coach. They have to go in style. They go first class, so you go on the expense account. So when you're working, when you're being Mamet's Torah, there's a certain concept that you're going on, you're working for the company. So the CEO of the company, Ribono Shel Olam, you have an expense account. So sort of a lot of things that, you get busy, sometimes you can't learn as much. There are certain things that you're not going to be able to do. You have to relax sometimes. So when you're working, you're working in a place accounting. So, okay, when you're not working, you should be learning. Okay, you can't take a rest. But when you're on the expense account, everything changes. I'm not saying a person shouldn't capitalize and use it all of his time, but the things that are needed, you sort of put it on the company's account because you're working for the company. So okay, I'm not saying that someone who's an accountant can't also trigger this, but it has to. It'll be a little more complicated. He has to have the right mindset that he, even though he's an accountant, but he's an Elohim accountant, and his ikar is that he's an Ovid Hashem. And yes, a person could trigger it that way also, but You need a little bit more lumdus to do it that way. So that's the third reason that then you're working and everything you do is come out on the expense account because you're working for the CEO of the company. Then I want to go like this. Let's say a person wants to go, what's in it for me? Brad Foyman used to always say, you always have to broadcast on WIFM. WIFM is what's in it for me. What am I getting out of this? So we did the real thing is different reasons. But okay, that's what the Rashid was such a genius. He started off the whole chinuch concept with salaries. He just started going through salaries. So nowadays, you know, if a person is a trained mechanech, they can make, you know, a lot of money. For six digits, you can make for a person, you know, well into the six digits. And, you know, mechanechim, if a person's ready to become like a principal out of town, I'm not saying yeshiva like this, but if a person's ready to become like a day school principal, a real day school principal, they're making $150,000-$200,000. Day school principals. You know, they're making real money. And the world has recognized that. There's one guy in yeshiva who asked me, you know, he got a job offer in one of the branches to be like a 10th grade rabbi, 11th grade rabbi. He's excellent. But he was also offered to go to a more of a day school outside the system, I think 7th grade or 8th grade. So I told him, and he asked me, I said, listen, you know, the yeshiva is producing so few pure mechanchim, people who really know chinuch. You have the chush for it. So if you go take the Rebbe job, you'll be a very good Rebbe, but you won't get any training, probably. You know, I know where he was going. I don't think he'll get too much training. It was a Chabad Chai Yeshiva, or good place, but he wouldn't get any training. But if you go to the other place, they're going to train you, they'll send you for courses, they'll pay for it, and you'll become a Gadol Mechanech, and we just don't have enough people who have the chush to do that. So he did everything. He calls me once a year to thank me for that advice. He got offered the job at the yeshiva, you know, different branches a few times, but he's becoming a godfather. He's for sure gonna make a lot of money, because there are very few people that can, you know, ready to go out of town, and someone who could take on a lot of achrayas and is trained to do it. So they can make a lot of money. I am not at all exaggerating. $150,000-$200,000 is, you know, for sure. I mean, some people make more than that, but you make $150,000-$200,000. Yeah, I'm not talking about yeshiva ours, but in any other place than the yeshivish places, you know, the day schools out of town. Yes, you can make a lot of money. A person should realize that. You make as much money as you would, you know, non-chinuch things. It's viewed as a professional, and the world realizes that now. But the thing is like this, the training is crucial. So a person, you know, it's not hard to get trained, like learning is crucial. You know, a person, I think my son-in-law's mother, I guess I can't say this over, but that she was nervous that when he was learning in Kolo, so, you know, she felt like he doesn't have any secular degree. So she called me up, since, you know, he'll probably listen to me, not gonna listen to her. And if I tell him to go to college to get a degree, he'll go to college and get a degree. So she asked me what I thought when I told him that. And I said, no, I'm probably not gonna tell him that, but not for the reason you think. It's not because I think college is trade for like that, but like this, you're assuming that if he goes to college, he's going to help him get a proper job in chinuch, right? She goes, yeah, I do. I said, but what you're not realizing is that when he's learning, that's going to be what he's teaching. What he's learning now, not the exact, but it puts him on a level to be able to give over to his talmidim on a higher level, on a deeper level. That will make him more attractive. That will make him have more sipuk, will make have the kids have more sipuk from him if he's on a bigger lamdan. So, and that's vaday going to help him. Whether or not he can get the job with that degree, many people get the jobs they're looking for without the degree. You know, so, you know, you're asking him to trade one thing, trade something that vaday is going to help him for something that might help him. It's at least a wash. So he said, you're 100% right. You backed off. 100% right. I said, and after he finishes learning, he can go get a degree at nights or online. He can get a degree. If, you know, if he feels he needs it, he could do that. So the training is important. I'm going to give you a few examples. Lamashal, how to make a goal, a yearly goal for a class. That takes training. You know, suppose, okay, what do you mean goal? I'm going to Gadusha, we'll start from days, and well, the goal is around Yud Aleph. It's like goal, Yud Aleph. No. That's enough for goal. Anyone was here, or you weren't here over the summer, but you see a lot of the Rebbeim here. You had Menachem Zev Kramer, Rebbeinu's son-in-law. He was here from early morning to late at night. Menachem Zev Kramer is a brilliant mechanic, brilliant Rebbe. And he, Damon Shakwis, I saw him here. He was here from 9:15 a.m. until late at night, till 10 o'clock at night, just working on, and I don't know if he's teaching Gemara, Chumash, you know, all the different subjects. He was becoming a fluent and a master, how to teach, proper worksheets, proper activities. You get the kids excited about it. That takes a plan. How he's going to chart that out. You can't just obviously you have to do something every night to prepare, but to be able to make a goal for the year, that takes, it's an art. And if a person doesn't make a goal, he usually doesn't accomplish what he wants to accomplish. He must have a goal. Rabbi Gumlad always tells over the Maisa that every year when he learned the Masechta, he always tried to finish the Masechta when he was doing it. Okay, he had to put in extra time, but he pushed to finish the Masechta every year. And then when he got to Bava Basra, he said, okay, Bava Basra, 175, I don't know, 30, that's already, you know, he can't do that. So he didn't make a goal that year to finish the Masechta. But that year, he learned, not only didn't he finish the Masechta, he learned like 40 blot less than every other year. And that's simply from not having a goal. He should have made a goal. They could have not finished that, I'll do 150 blot. And he would have done it, or whatever, 140 blot. He didn't make a goal. When you don't make a goal, you don't complete what you have to do. So obviously it's a good musa for ourselves in yeshiva. That's why we try and have quotas. And you have to try and stick to it by hook or by crook. I use that method when I prepared for the Mishnah Berurah Chaburah. You know, I spent a long time figuring out how much a person can do every day. I left a little room to bug out, a little room. I left a little room to chazer, because you have to chazer and leaves the people who are behind to catch up without feeling they're behind. And, you know, I use the same system. I'm mamish on track. You know, without having to huff and puff. It's an art to learn how to make a yearly goal. That doesn't come naturally. Learning how to teach kids why what they're learning is relevant to them. So, I wish somebody would have done it for me, but I was going to college for accounting, and my Rebbeim all knew, and no one told me this. I took accounting with a half a head, and I had to get through this. My parents wanted me to get an accounting degree, and I have a lot of stories about that whole episode, but somebody told me that if you have an accounting degree and you go into chinuch and you become a Rosh Hashiva, you are 20 steps ahead of everyone else because you will understand all of the finances of the yeshiva and you help direct the yeshiva. I mean, because I took accounting, I know more than the average person who's a reshiva, what do they know about balance sheet. So I don't know a whole lot, but I know enough. And had I known this earlier, it would have made it so much more relevant. So you can imagine when you're teaching something to a kid and you tell them this is going to help them. Like most kids in the high school, when they're learning trigonometry, they have no idea why they ever created trigonometry, myself included. I have no idea why anyone ever created trigonometry. The person should be shot. Why would they make trigonometry? But if the trig teacher, if he's a really good math teacher, and he could show them which things in the world need trigonometry, I went to Amazon tour Where was I when I did that? Yeah, in Tennessee. I was on one vacation to Chattanooga. So my son, you know, big Amazon guy, he arranged for the tour. His best buddies with the whatever, the owner of Amazon. So the guy took us in. I asked him a couple of questions. He says, "Oh, do we use algorithms for that?" Algorithms. I remember the word algorithms in one of my math classes. What did that mean again? I asked him, "Was algorithms again?" I have no idea. I still don't know. He answered me. I have no idea what algorithms are. But if somebody would have told me that, I would have been so excited to learn about algorithms. Algorithms is going to help me, you know, own Amazon.
What makes Bezos and Olive of Kedushin exciting? It's going to help you learn.
I didn't say I could do it on the spot. I didn't say I could do it on the spot. But yes, yeah, you could do it on the spot. You could tell somebody, not Bezos and Olive, you could tell what it will help, how it will help a person knowing how to learn, knowing how to decipher, knowing how to decode, knowing how to split up a Tosfos.
But just everything,
you know,
is the same.
I'll give you one thing you could understand that I didn't understand when I was in yeshiva. Say muschabur. You don't need to say it in front of 10 of your friends. But it's not just to say, why did I say it over to a Rebbe? If the Rebbe likes it, it's good. If the Rebbe doesn't like it, it's no good. Well, you have to go ahead and say it over to your friends again for it. Like public speaking, when I do that public speaking, I'm not a public speaker. But you see, it did help me very much. I had tremendous fear of, I don't know, let's not go into the fear, but I had tremendous fear. And to get over the fear, I just took upon myself to say over as many shmuzim as I could to as many people as often as I could. Just to get past the fear of people like asking you a question. You go to a lot of Rabbanim who say shmuzim, you go over and ask them a question. First of all, don't do that. They don't like it because they never went through the Ar Yeshiva's experience. They like when you ask them a question, nice shmuz, so beautiful. Then they say it over the air, wasn't that beautiful? Yeah, it's so beautiful. But if you ask them a question, you tell them, like, they don't see that from there. You know, they're going to throw you out of the shul, don't ever go back there again. They don't like it. I've watched many people, they don't like it. But that's really relevant. So learning how, first of all, you learn how to think, you know, to understand the Machlokas Rashi and Tosfos, to know why Rashi argues on Tosfos, to why Tosfos didn't say like Rashi, what Rashi thought of Tosfos, but he didn't like it for this reason, but Tosfos says like this. That whole process, you know, it's not this vibe, but you could learn Seichel, just simple, what, you know, what's a good sfera, what's a bad sfera, just from working out what Rashi didn't like about Tosfos, what Tosfos didn't like about Rashi, and if you can't figure out what Tosfos didn't like about Rashi, means you're missing something, Pshat and Rashi, there's some Pshat and Tosfos, as sharp as the mind, able to think. Kaseder, they tell us that the yeshiva guys in law school are far, 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 far superior coming in than anyone else, because they're trained to be able to think and to think of differences. That the whole thing in law is all precedents. So you come up with precedent, you're a good lawyer. If you can slug up the precedent, why this is different, it's a Tosfos. The yeshiva guys are bored, and everyone's saying, "Wow, how do you do that?" That's all the skill. So you tell a kid in ninth grade, by the way, if anyone here is planning to go to Yale Law, this is the class for you. It's pre-law. This is pre-law. Because then you tell them what a precedent is. I took business law. You tell them what a precedent is, and the judges, all they care about is precedent. You have to cite, you know, whatever, this case against the state of Lissas, and they said like this, so we have to pass my list. The lawyer says, nope, there's a difference over there. That there's the person who was walking across the street. Over there wasn't walking across the street. Therefore, it's different. It's mamashe chabura. That's what law is. Okay? So that's very, very helpful to know why it's relevant. I'll tell you, oh my gosh, 1027. Oh gosh, we're going to have to go or delay Marv or tell him to come without us. But I remember once, like, you know, let's say there's a Holocaust class. So they're, you know, doing Holocaust in middle school. They teach Holocaust. When I was in high school, they taught Holocaust. And it was a pain. I'd be honest with you, it was a pain to learn Holocaust. I didn't know about it. They had this book. You had to read it. It was just pressure. There were, and I can't say I enjoyed the class. But they didn't tell me how it would help me. Just the history. Like, I don't like history. It's okay. I don't like history. And there is one. But then what happened, when I moved to Miami, Rabbi Grunblatt came to me and said, you know, I teach a Holocaust class, you know, twice a week to 8th graders, and I can't have time for it, so you teach the class. And he wrote up the whole syllabus, and he handed me the file, and he gave it to me, and he just, I said, but I'm not an expert. He goes, no, just read straight from there. It's easy. It's right there, everything there. And every unit, I give a quiz, and every woman's a genius. He wrote it all himself, and okay, fine. So I started going to class. You know, I read it first, and I said, okay, it was like a teleprompter. You have it on there. Kids don't know. They don't see this stuff on your desk. So I said, okay, the Holocaust really started with the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. And kid raises his hand. Excuse me, Rebbe, what? What was the Treaty of Versailles? I had no idea. I knew how to pronounce it. I didn't say Versailles. So what's Treaty of Versailles? So, I had no idea. That's like really embarrassing. So I said, listen, if you're going to hack me up on every single word in the course, we won't get anywhere. We can't go into the Treaty of Versailles. That's old. I'm going to get the Holocaust. But I had such charata that if I would have listened, someone should have told me that, you know, one day, no one's going to remember the Holocaust. And I'm teaching this to you because you're going to be the last people standing. And when they tell you it didn't happen, you tell them you learned it in this classroom. And yes, the Holocaust did happen. Had they told me that, I would have paid attention. Okay, so... here's something that drives me crazy. That's the simplest thing that people coming in to give model lessons don't even cop this. But you know what it is when someone goes for a walk, I want to take you for a walk, and you're going to a new city, and you're walking, you have no idea where you are. You start feeling a little bit, where am I going? Oh, we're just going to shul. Okay, we go to shul, and you're walking, it's 2 blocks, 3 blocks. How further is it? It's just up ahead. And you look, you don't see any shul. You're walking, you don't know where you're going. It always seems like longer. So it's the same thing with learning. If you don't know what's at the end, you don't know what the goal is, it takes forever, it makes everyone stressed out. You have to learn, people have to learn how to write the objective on the board. Most teachers and most rabbis do not do that. That's like the number one thing I would tell them, which I do tell them, but still both of them listen. But this year I'm on vacation, I don't do that. But they have to write an objective on the board. What are you trying to accomplish with this lesson? So William Tosfos, oh, the objective on the board, Tosfos, Shava Kesef, Pekesef, Shkaya. That's not helpful. Tosfos, Shava Kesef. I'm sorry, I had Kedushin every day, right? Sex Kedushin. What do you want to get at Shava Kesef? What's the big deal? The Tosfos asks, by Shava Kesef, I think two questions and two answers. The whole Tosfos is two questions and two answers. You tell them. Tosfos has two questions and two answers. And this is on Kolkas, I don't remember. But I remember I broke down Tosfos over the summer. It distilled it to just a few steps. There are a lot of riots and stuff, but you could distill it. Hey, you have to prepare to know what the objective is. But what's the objective? So there's a machlokes, there's two shitas. We're going to have two shitas. We're going to see two opinions over here on what Shava Kesef is. Finished. You got to do that for them. But I know it's sometimes helpful to, you know, as they get older, to take them, not put it on a silver platter for them, but when they're younger, you got to give them an objective. When they're older, even a base medrash year, there has to be a what we're getting out of today's. What are we doing today? What's the objective of today? That even simply to know what we're getting out of there. Like today, when we started, I would have said this. And we two shittas on this Rashi. You know, the Kiska word today for those over there. The two shittas on a four-word Rashi. There's two shittas, whether it could be a Kaddish, a woman with ribbis or not. Some of focus which on them. But that Rashi picked one way is pretty. That's pretty phenomenal. You wouldn't think that right here in our Kedushin, you know, they can go to Shulchan Aruch right here in this Rashi. They bring a riot. So it's much helpful. A person knows. Wow, the halacha in Shulchan Aruch and Ebenezer, they bring riots from this Rashi that we did. And that Rashi, that's for me. Yeah. Next. You have to become a master on reward and punishment. A master.
Okay. I,
Are we explaining the pros and cons of becoming going to heaven?
Now I'm saying it, I'm still in Parnassa. I'm sorry, I should have made the objective clear. We're still in number four, it's great Parnassa, if you're trained. So I'm trying to show you trained. Here are the areas to get trained in. First of all, how to make a goal for the year and why it's important. Number two, I mentioned that teaching relevance. Sometimes you have to work on the relevance, but to teach relevance. Three, why an objective is important, how to write an objective. You can't just write, okay, the objective of this class, teach Shavu Kesef Kesef. In order to make it relevant, in order to make that objective relate to the kid, it has to be something that they will have to demonstrate. So you have to tell them that at the end of this class, you will be able to multiply 2 times 2. Or you will multiply 2 by 2 because you're going to be saying it over to someone. But then they feel like all accountability also. So show them today's lesson will be relevant immediately. Immediately. Next, reward and punishment. Okay, not, I don't mean punishment. We don't really do punishments anymore. they found that it's not educationally helpful to do punishment, but when I say punishment, I really mean consequence, but there are a lot of people still doing punishments, so we're going to talk about it. If a person could turn everything into a positive, it's gevaldig. I'll give you 2 examples. When I was my first couple of years here in Miami, it was in the old building on 71st Street in Miami Beach, and the place could not, we had no money, and I couldn't be part of it, but we could not afford a custodian. So the custodians came in at 6:30, and they cleaned up till 11:30, 12, and the building was spotless from 12 midnight till 7 a.m. Spotless. You could bring your grandmother in, and she'd be so impressed. Unfortunately, no grandmothers came between 12 and 7 a.m. People came between 7 a.m. and 6 p.m., and it was a pigsty. It was so bad that in the dining room, which was a smaller dining room than this, but there was a dining room, at one point in the day, there was not one tile that you could see. The orange peels were on the floor. The yeshiva couldn't afford tablecloths. So there were no tablecloths. So at the breakfast, they gave kids on a rotation a bucket of water with some spritz and some shmatas, and they had on a rotation clean the tables. That was the yeshiva. And it was a disaster. And that was my first year, and I remember telling Rabbi Grumblatt that this is unacceptable. It's terrible. What are we supposed to do? So we have to hire someone to do it. We can't hire someone to do it. I said, this Torah system is not working. Nobody wants to do it. They all kvetch, they all leave. And so I was in charge of getting the guys who didn't do it to come back. So they get it back. You know, you get a kid who doesn't want to do something, he has to clean it. So he cleans it. You know, it was a little bit better than before, but, you know, what do you expect him to be a custodian? Not going to be a custodian. So I had a bet with Rabbi Grumblatt. So he said, What do you want to do? I said, if he wanted to do it, you could do it. You know, I said, okay, I don't know how to do it. I said, okay, I will do it. Just as a bet to Rabbi Grumblatt. We had a mamash a bet. I was telling him that it was his job. He was the principal. So I told Grumblatt, you know, you have to do this. And he couldn't do it. So I had a bet. This is what I did. Okay. I said, well, what's a kid going to enjoy? So I bought a case of Coca-Cola, cans of Coca-Cola, 24, and I bought like 4 of them. And I put them in the fridge, I locked the fridge. They were ice cold cans of soda. Then I had my wife make these big 2 bottles of Coca-Cola, like with the ice beads dripping down these 2-liter bottles, and there was a big, it was like, took up like 3 of these frames. That's how big I did it. And in the middle it said the Coca-Cola Club. Then I put on the side a bunch of papers in there, applications to join the Coca-Cola Club. And I wrote your name. I got this idea from someone, your name. and I wrote what the Coca-Cola Club, if you get accepted, what you could do, you can help us keep Yeshiva Torah Sky beautiful by having access into the dining room, because we used to lock it because it was so dirty. We used to lock in the afternoons. You will have a key to the dining room at certain times, and you will help keep it beautiful. And if after inspection it's good, you can go to the refrigerator and you can get an ice cold can of soda, and you could drink it in class. In class. So I handed it. I apologize. Only 12 can be. Only accepting 12. They let every single kid in the school applied. Had like 28 seventh and eighth graders, and a few high school kids. They applied too, and everyone applied. I only accepted the top 12. No, on the bottom it was said for office use only. You know, it had to have approval recommended by two teachers. So they had to get two teachers to sign. They had to go to the teachers and get two teachers to sign that they approved of them to do this. So they. And they did that. I had 12 guys that were dying to clean the dining room. And the place was mamish spotless. So after like the second day, I don't mean no disrespect. I know Rabbi Gumbat's the, you know, the Rashiva now, but this was the early days, you know. I tapped Rabbi Gumbat on the shoulder. I said, take a look. He looked in there. I said, hey up. He remembers the story because he's told it over in Queens many times. So we were, I'll tell you another maysa. That first year, the classroom was very hard to control, eighth graders.
What's pshat and why that works? It sounds so...
No, I'm going to show you. I want to make a point. I want to say both these mices. So I can't say which name of the yeshiva because it could come out a little bit Lashon Hara. So I won't say the name of the yeshiva. One of the big, big, big time yeshivas in New York. And I knew I had a friend of mine was a Rebbe in one of these yeshivas. I called him up. I said, I'm having some trouble. My first year teaching. And could you get me in to look at different Rebbeim so I could see some techniques? I'm teaching eighth grade. So I'll get you into the eighth grade Rebbe. So I go into the eighth grade Rebbe. And there's stories to say about that, but I just want to take one point. So the eighth grade Rebbe, if a kid wasn't behaving, which they weren't, anyone wasn't behaving, he said, told them they had to stand. So there were like four kids standing, five kids standing, one kid kicked out. You didn't behave. He made you stand up. That was the Chachma in the 1990s. Okay. Later that day, I also went in. He said, you want to see, there's a great first grade Rebbe. I said, you know, let me see the first grade Rebbe. So I go down to the first grade Rebbe, and you wouldn't believe, it was Mamash from the Ribbono Shlom did this. Do you know what this Rebbe did as a reward if you behaved? Anybody want to guess?
Stand up.
He let them stand. Everybody else had to sit. So the same, I learned something so important. The same action could be used as a reward or a punishment, depends what you want to do. So this Rebbe was brilliant. He told them, if you do what you have to do, I'm going to let you stand. These first graders, they're easy to motivate, much easier than eighth grade. I'm not saying it's not easier, but so the whole standing could have been used either way. That takes work. You have to become trained in that. There are classes in that, how to motivate kids to do that. The next item, we're almost finished. The next item is a vart I learned from Rabbi Foreman, but I really try and live by it. Because a lot of parents have to learn this also, but people here have heard it from me. Authority, once executed, is eroded. I'll say it again. Authority, once executed, is eroded. That means that if you use your authority that you have to do something, I have the authority, I'm the principal, I'm going to suspend the kid, you actually have, you have just lowered yourself when you have to execute it and you suspend the kid, your authority is lessened. The whole authority is the mirsus of what you could do. But once you do it, it'll be less effective next time. Yeah, you spend it already. What's going to accomplish? So a person wants to administer as least amount of authority as possible. Having the authority is where all the power comes from. So like parents who yell, or a teacher who yells, or a Rebbe who yells, is aside from other emotional reasons and lack of demotivating reasons, but there's a partial reason why you shouldn't do that. You're executing your authority, and you actually wrote it, because they're going to say, okay, he yelled at me last time, he's a yeller, nothing's going to happen or do anything. So authority once executed is eroded. That's a very important skill to learn. And therefore, a person has to learn, okay, how are you going to do it? Here's the next one. Maybe before I get to that, I'll just about on the authority thing. There's a concept which, you know, I know there are educators who disagree with this, but Rabbi Feuerman, on these and Yonim, you know, he knew, he read, and he researched. So the things he said were not his own hashkafas. So it was based on the research. But 90% of student misbehavior is teacher-induced. It's a phenomenal, remarkable. But 90%, if you're a teacher in the classroom, a rebbe in the classroom, 90% of student misbehavior is teacher-induced. That means that if you are asked to take over a class, or a kid is going to come to you and say, can you take over my class for a day? And I think you should do it if you have time to prepare. It's a great, good experience. And the kids are misbehaving 90% of the time. I mean, 100% of the time, that you can assume that 90% of it is your fault. 90% is your fault. Before you yell at the kids, which you're not going to yell because authority once executed is eroded, but you could assume that 90% of it is your fault. 10%, it could happen anyway, and 10% of the kids are probably mishugoyim and they didn't take their medication and it wouldn't help anyway. But 90% is your fault. You weren't prepared properly, you didn't realize this and you should have realized that, you forgot to ask the previous Rebbe about that kid, you overshot, you undershot, you know, the perfect lesson has yet to been taught, so it's okay, it doesn't have to be perfect. But before you get upset at the kids, no one likes to get upset themselves, but just realize that, okay, you're going to be prepared differently next time. Okay, I want to get into emotional quotient, and again, we're trying to wrap it up. Emotional quotient. Emotional quotient is a pashut. It's pashut. Once you deher it, it's pashut, and just knowing it is not enough. I myself need to remind myself often to use it, use the wisdom of this, which I don't do enough. Emotional quotient like this. If I want to go over to, Errol, and I want to tell him that, you know, I'd like him to give me more, more fries when I'm there. So he's not giving me enough. So you have to view it like you're about to make a withdrawal from the relationship. You're asking for a favor. So you're making a withdrawal. So withdrawals are great. You can make a withdrawal. You like to make withdrawals from your bank account. But this is the emotional bank account, the emotional quotient. You have to know if you're making a withdrawal, when do you make deposits? You can only make a withdrawal if you have deposits. So if you plan on telling him that he needs to give you more fries, then you're going to make a few deposits. So what you would do the day before is, Errol, thank you very much. The meal was delicious on day one. On day two, you know, thank you. Things are so organized over here. I never saw a place like this. Thank you so much. The third day, you told him to say, you know, I don't know how you do it. It's so hot and everyone's driving you crazy and you always, you know, keep it together. Thank you so much. Okay, that's deposits. And the fourth day, you say, I hate to trouble you, but do you think you'd be able to give me some more fries? Sure, why don't you say so? But if you go over the first day, yeah, get out of here, you. I'm not promising it'll work, but it's withdrawal and deposits. It's deposits and withdrawals. A person has to realize that. And when you attack a person and, you know, set on, like, do you notice in the airlines, if somebody stands up I just noticed, stumbled onto this myself. If somebody stands up while they're like taxiing or starting to taxi, they're just getting up, they might get their purse from there, from the racks above, take a second, they stand up. As soon as they stand up, you hear a flight attendant go on the thing and says, the captain has told us that in order for us to take off, everyone needs to be seated. They don't say, hey, you over there, yeah, you, the fatso in the aisle. They don't say that. Because if they would say that, excuse me, sit down, they'll lose a customer. People can't handle it. So they try and minimize the damage by doing it that way. So that's basically a good thing to keep in mind. The less a person has to withdraw, the better. I used to do, like, when the kids were talking a lot, instead of telling them to be quiet, would you be quiet, would you be quiet, would you be quiet, I sometimes would say, and it's probably because I wasn't prepared, but when I had to make something like that, I put it on myself. Say, guys, I apologize. I don't know if this is the right thing, but I would say, like, I didn't take my meds today. I can't concentrate. Everyone be quiet, please, so I can think. I would say that sometimes. But I'm not saying it was the right thing to do because, you know, I don't want to make fun of anyone taking medication. I didn't mean to do that, but I would put it on me. I would put it on me, guys. I feel so bad. I'm so sorry. I mamish can't concentrate. Give me a minute. He's trying to ask a question. I can't concentrate. I'm so sorry. My brain is mush. I'm so sorry. Could you give me I would put it on me.
Doesn't it take a personality type to do that?
Yeah, it does. It does. Okay. The point is to try and take it off the individual. When I was in Beis Medrash, okay, I don't want to say which year, but one day the Rebbe, whoever the Rebbe wasn't the Rashiva, the Rebbe wasn't there, and a substitute, okay, one of the earlier shir, a substitute came in. Okay, obviously it was a chashuv person, came to give shir. And somebody was talking to his friend next to me. It wasn't even me. And he stopped talking. You know, sometimes the Rebbe talks, and you talk to the person next to you. And the Rebbe stood there, and he waited. And when the guy looked up, he said, I'm waiting for you. To this day, I can't. It still bothers me. And he wasn't even saying it to me. I didn't think it was appropriate for someone to do that, for someone who's 20, 19 years old, to, like, we're waiting for you. Like, he was talking and learning. He wasn't talking about sports. He was talking and learning, and so, like, and I'm still affected by it. It's a long time ago. And it still bothers me. Now, I'm probably an overly sensitive, hypersensitive person, and he wasn't even yelling at me, but we have to be careful, you know, that's an art, to learn how to, you know, how to correct. That's a course in itself, learning how to correct in ways that the kids don't realize you're correcting them. So there are ways to do that. There's an art, there's a whole course in that. You know, the captain has told us that's a course. I'm sure they learned that somewhere, because every flight attendant does that. No flight attendant on any airline says, you, in the aisle, sit down. They don't say that. They say, the captain has asked that everyone go out so that we can take off and no delays. Let's see. Yeah. It's amazing how much, how effective chesed gets us. So it's easy. If a person's having a problem, there are two ways to do it. I've heard teachers say, you know, this is a hard class. You're going to have to put in a lot of time for this. If you want to pass this class, you're going to have to put in a lot of hard time. Yeah, you could do that. But if the teacher would just add one more thing, he'd become a hero. This is a very hard class. Guys, don't worry. I'm here. I'm going to help you. I'm going to teach you this material that you'll be able to do it. You're going to have to put in your time. I'm going to help you do it. If he just would add that in, it would make all the difference. And then you have to follow through. You have to really care about it. And then the last thing I want to say is, it's also training. I'll say it over in 10 seconds, which this will end, but there's also a study of the brain, but attention spans. Just to understand what attention span is. So attention spans, the research tells us that a person's attention span, maximum attention span of a human being, is 1 minute for every year they are old, which maxes out at 18. So there is no attention span that's longer than 18 minutes. You can look it up in the research yourself, Google it or whatever. Attention span is not longer than 18 minutes for an 18-year-old, not more than that, and that's maximum. We should not assume people are, you know, tzaddikim. You have to assume they're betinim. So assume like 10, 12 minutes is probably what a person's shooting for. Doesn't mean your class is 12 minutes and you go to recess. It just means at that point, there has to be a certain amount of review, summary, some kind of activity, and then you do another lesson. Then you can even go further. But the actual attention span is 1 minute for every year they're old, and it maxes out at 18. So I just did a few things on the time I had set down beforehand and tried to think things that one would need training for. Yeah, a person should get training in this to study the brain and to really understand how that really works and what happens when a person's attention span goes, where does his mind go, why can't he do it, and the different types of things that could energize the person, which activities work. There's such a thing as team building and brain rests, and you know, there are a lot of different ways to do it. There's Ramesh, you know, you spend a lot of money, a lot of time on it, but if a person gets trained to understand these things, you go well into the six digits. Okay? Well, I was here in Miami. I was already at North Miami Beach. I think I was already principal. I got a call from a day school out of town. They were, I don't know how much the salary was, but they said just for agreeing to take the job, they will give me $250,000.
What?
A signing bonus. Wow. That was not talking about the salary. They will give me $250,000 if I take the job just to put in the bank. I want to say yes. I think my salary then was like $50,000. And then she wasn't even paying all the salary. I was going like, yeah. I thought I was crazy for saying no to that. $250,000 in the bank. Starting bonus. But the out of town places, they need good people. And yeah, every person, you know.
Not everybody's going to get into that job. You're talking about
So a person could say, anything a person trains for, he may flunk out of that also. You know, there are schleppers in every profession. There are schleppers. So Hayos Midvarenu, I say over from my Rebbe, the Reshiva, Rebbe out of town makes whatever $70,000. They let the Reshiva started. I didn't know what he was talking about. But the main thing is I thought that I had no shyness, and I was wrong. When I was 17 at the time when the Reshiva was saying that, and I thought he totally missed the boat. And you know, how's that shyness? I wanted to play for the New York Yankees. Still then. I thought there was a chance. I could still make it. And, you know, I had enough talent to think that I could do it. I wasn't totally in La La Land, but you know, I had no shaykhis to going to chinuch, you know, and thought of it, and no one had ever mentioned that to me. I couldn't relate to anyone that I knew who wasn't chinuch. But a person should realize that if a person has potential, they should don't write it off. You can make a lot of money, and you have to speak to your parents, speak to your Rebbeim, and realize you may be able to do it. And again, I'm not saying a person has to do it, but if a person would be thinking about doing it, those would be some of the reasons. There are skusim, but there's also practical reasons. A person would make a very good parnosa from it. Okay, and there are a lot of perks. Yerof, Sukkos, Pesach. And then everybody helps you out. The community also always feels bad, you know, Rebbeim, you know, and they give all these chas de lev things. It's worth thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And you know, that they just want to help out. So like, one of my chaverim told me, he went into big business, making a lot of money. He said, like, you know, you don't realize that, you know, everything's very hard. You know, so, bam, you're a rebbe. They don't want to charge them. They give you offer tuition, and they, you know, they care about you. You're in the business, you know, you're helping out, like professional courtesy. So you're off all the yomim tovim. I cannot offer all summer, and like that, because if you're in that level, there's work to do. But think about it. You're always with chevra, you know. Shifty Beves Hashem Kol Yemei Chayei. Where else would you get such a life like that? It's not so simple to turn away, because especially in the old days when you're in Europe, okay, you know, you're gonna be, you know, you can't even afford shoelaces. But this is America nowadays. It's America. You know, if a person really become professional at it, it's a top earning profession, very respected. But you have to be. You know, I'm saying that it should be good. If you're doing it, it should be good. And you have to be trained in yeshiva. A person should be trained in yeshiva. We have a good system that, you know, pedagogy, a person trained in yeshiva, you'll be normal. We don't tell people to go, you know, be a bizayon. They have to be respectable. Learn how to talk to people. You take courses here and there. Nowadays, they have courses in yeshiva. So a person should consider it. Okay, Shkar, thank you.